Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Homegrown national journalist Goldie Taylor is with us a little bit later in this program. Hear what she has to say about sexual abuse in today's politics. She is an abuse victim. But first, given the productivity of American agriculture, some might find it odd to suggest that we rethink how we farm. Some scientists warn of dire consequences if we don't. Our guests on today's program think we have to bring nature back to farming. What does that really mean? Joining me are Scott Allegrucci, Senior Development and Communications Officer for the Land Institute. The Institute is looking at new models for achieving and sustaining food security. Dr. Allison Miller is an associate professor at St. Louis University and a research associate at the Missouri Botanical Garden. She joins us by phone from Washington. And Dr. Wendy Applequist is a member of the Garden Science and Conservation staff. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Most interesting program. Scott, let me begin with you. I want to take a quote from your website, in which you say, the Land Institute says, for at least 10,000 years, humans have disrupted natural ecological systems and kept them in a continuous state of disruption in order to feed our populations and avoid famine. This, in a nutshell, is agriculture as we know it. Increasingly, the modern scale of those agricultural disruptions threatens to collapse the critical cultural and natural systems upon which we depend. That sounds most ominous indeed.
Well, if it is ominous, it's a long time coming. It's a 10,000 to 12,000 year challenge. And I think one of the key things to frame how we approach that narrative is that to say that it's a challenge, or to say that that word disruptions, it's really more of a literal and technical term for us than it is sort of a value judgment, although that can be true as well. I mean, the fact is, in order to produce food the way we produce it now, but really the way our ancestors began producing food 10,000 years ago, you have to destroy or disrupt this natural system that's there in order to favor very specific plants with very specific traits. And then that relationship between humans, plants, and the land has been really more or less the same for almost 10,000 years. And we mine from there to grow things here, water, petroleum turned into chemicals, minerals that we deplete from the soil because we've disrupted that system. So it's really more of a literal and kind of technical assessment, and in no way, to the degree it's ominous, it's a challenge we all share.
So if we continue to do it the way we've been doing it, and we're, of course, extraordinarily productive doing it this way,
we're good at it.
What happens if we just continue in this path?
Well, I mean, there are water issues, both in terms of quality and quantity. So you're using water at a rate faster than it can be replaced in the natural cycle. And, there's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that's the size of some of the states of the United States. And so that's a cost of the current model of productivity in largely in Midwestern corn agriculture. Mm-hmm. But it's costing shrimp fishermen and other fishermen and the natural systems a great deal of productivity, and in fact threatens their very existence. Soil is where our organization really started. I mean, our founder, Wes Jackson, along with others, was, these were people who came out of the soil conservation programs and education and philosophy of the post-Dust Bowl era. And yet by the 60s and 70s, we're seeing that we were losing soil still at an enormous rate. And again, it's a... on a geologic time frame, it's a renewable resource, but not on our time frame.
Allison, what is research telling us about how to deal with this?
Well, we're living in a really exciting time, Don, where there's just a ton of different approaches and ideas for this challenge of trying to feed a growing population in a changing climate. One of the things that we're interested in doing in my group is looking at native species that perhaps didn't enter the domestication pipeline when agriculture first started 10,000 years ago, and beginning to tap into that wild biodiversity and see if we can identify candidate species, and then together with collaborators develop alternative crops that might meet some of the needs that we have today, but perhaps do so in a more sustainable way.
So we're giving up tomatoes and corn for something else?
Not entirely. I don't know if any of us are arguing for a whole transition or shift, but perhaps rethinking the way we're doing things today and working towards another alternative. So I don't think it's an either or situation. I think it's developing another alternative.
Wendy Applequist, what is the Botanical Gardens' role in all of this?
Well, we're not an agronomic institution. Right. We don't have large-scale fields or, sure. or cultivation facilities. What we're providing to this is primarily information. Well, two things, actually. One is information on the ethnobotany and toxicology of perennial herbaceous legumes and grasses and oil seeds to help inform the selection of candidates for domestication. And then the other thing we're providing is access to a special project in the world's largest freely accessible botanical database, Tropicos. This is a huge database that includes species information, information on individual specimens, names, literature, collectors, and also specific projects. And the Perennial Agriculture Project is a project within Tropicos, and it will contain a database eventually of all of the herbaceous perennial potential domesticates.
Scott, from what I've been able to learn about this prior to the program, is that perennial is a key to all of this, isn't mm-hmm. it? In other words, growing things that will you don't have to replant every year.
That's right. In general, not in a purely quantitative way, but it's half of the equation, and polyculture is the other half. So the perennial is important for just the reasons you mentioned. The disruptions you mentioned initially include plowing, tillage on an annual basis, and the inputs that are required. If you have perennials, the idea is that you begin to move into a system that doesn't require as much disruption. And it's also a system based upon every natural ecosystem that we've ever encountered is really grounded on perennials in polyculture. We changed that with agriculture and moved it to an annual system, but it then puts the burden back upon us to keep it that way. And then the other half is the polyculture. Plants growing. This is part of the question you raised too with Allison, that part of this is not that in some cases the plant species or the types of plants we grow for food may change over time. But what's also likely to happen, we hope, is that the way we grow them and that we grow them together in different combinations may emerge. And so it's not always a case of new plants as it is a case of new ways to grow them together.
Allison, I guess this is where the prairie connection comes in, right? Would you explain that to our audience, the prairie and the polyculture component?
Sure. Well, the really novel, I think, contributions of the Land Institute and the work of Wes Jackson was this idea that if we want to achieve a sustainable agricultural system, we need to develop a system that mimics natural ecosystems. And as Scott was saying, most natural ecosystems involve perennial plants. Those are plants that live for multiple years that are growing in mixtures. And so the idea is to try to develop this perennial polyculture, the two halves of the equation, where we have perennial long-lived crop plants that are yielding at a rate that is sufficient for our demands, but that they're grown in a way in mixtures that mimic the natural ecosystem.
Wendy, there's something about this I don't understand. I hope you're the right one to ask about this. And that is, if you're growing perennial plants for consumption, when you consume them, they're not there anymore. So what difference does it make if they're perennial or not?
Well, if this were a root crop, that would be true, but they're specifically looking at seed crops. So the idea is you would come through with a mechanical harvester and cut off the seed heads, sort the seeds, use the seeds, and the roots would remain in the ground and resprout the next year, just as they do in nature in a prairie.
The seeds would then be what is consumed?
Yeah. If you think about most of our diet is directly or indirectly based on grain and legume seeds, so soybean and the main grains like corn and wheat, rice. If the roots were perennial, we wouldn't have to damage the plant to harvest them. We could just come and take the seeds.
Or you could even graze them. You could introduce animals in and graze the cellulose that remains after you've taken the seeds, and you still got the roots, potentially.
And that adds even more to the fertilizing effect you get from growing a legume in with the grass.
which is something obviously very desirable if you can incorporate all of this together as opposed to doing them separately with artificial fertilizers.
Right, and it's that phrase that Allison mentioned, which is one of the guiding phrases for the Land Institute's work, is nature as the measure. So it's not an aesthetic idea necessarily, although it can be. It's a technical idea. It's a scientific idea to say we work within the – nature does this in its own ways, and it does it before we get there. So now we have the ability, we believe, to work in partnership with nature as long as we stay within those bounds.
Well, one quick question, as long as we're associating this with kind of like a prairie concept, I'm under the impression that that prairies have to burn periodically in order to regenerate themselves. How does this work into the whole thing?
Well, so again, remember the two pieces of perennial polyculture. So the perennial is really the crop development piece essentially, and then the polyculture is the sort of management piece. And we do believe that fire and grazing will be management tools for grain polycultures. So we're just beginning some of the research we're undertaking now with partners around this country and in some other countries involves either simulating or actually moving to grazing, and then we'll also begin investigating what it means to burn as a management tool in a crop system.
So grazing would accomplish the same thing that a burn would do?
In some cases. Different reactions in different regions and with different species.
Right. Did you want to say something? Go ahead, Wendy.
Well, just that the primary purpose for burning in a prairie is to get rid of the woody plants that start to sprout up and that grazing animals might not want to eat. So I suspect those will be complementary techniques.
All right, I've got to take a break now. This is fascinating stuff. The idea of changing the entire system is most interesting indeed. And that's what we're talking about doing, changing the way we farm. With me in studio is Scott Allegrucci, Senior Development and Communications Officer for the Land Institute, and from associations with the Missouri Botanical Garden, Dr. Allison Miller and Dr. Wendy Applequist. We'll be back in just a little bit. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Okay, one of the big issues in farming today is genetically modified crops. Does this play a role in what we're talking about, Scott?
Not in the sense that I think most people would intend it. I mean, the Land Institute conducts no genetic modification. There's no transgenetic work done, trans-species work done in our genes. I mean, most of the work that we do is, I wouldn't say it's traditional at this point because the tools involved have come so far so quickly, but it's basically Mendelian genetics. It's basically plant breeding in the way that it has been done for generations. There are some interesting changes, though, that are very important. The computational power available to our researchers and their collaborators and partners has grown exponentially even in the last decade. So, you know, when you're breeding, you're talking about – I was talking to one of our primary agronomists and breeders, he said, you know, sometimes there are trillions of possible combinations that you have to investigate mm-hmm. when you're looking for specific traits. This is, Allison intimated this earlier, this is partly why we believe our ancestors 10,000 years ago and subsequently did not develop perennial crops. It's perhaps, we think, increasingly more likely, not because it is impossible, but just simply because once you find the traits that you want in a plant, you enter a dance with those plants. I mean, they guide civilization every bit as much as humans are guiding their development. So we still work in a fairly traditional way with some very sophisticated tools and with a boatload more computational power than was even available a decade ago. That makes a big difference.
Allison, go ahead, Allison.
I was going to say something to keep in mind here is, as Scott mentioned, perennial herbaceous plants were rarely domesticated by early farmers. And domestication is the evolutionary process that happens as farmers selectively cultivate wild plants and choose the traits in those plants that they want to have increase in frequency over generations. And the Land Institute, the scientists there are doing something really novel in that they're conducting essentially de novo domestication, which is new domestication of wild, perennial, herbaceous species that really have never been cultivated or grown for food. And so I think some of the more advanced, modern, some of the techniques that might fall under the category of genetic modification at this point are not, I don't know if it would be even possible to consider that in these taxa, because they're essentially wild, and are just a few generations into the selection, the selective cycle.
Wendy, is there any kind of feedback? And again, anyone who wants to get in on the answer to this question, feel free to do so. Any kind of feedback from the big agri-science companies? I think of Monsanto, for instance, which may not be real happy to hear this kind of talk.
Well, at the moment, there's hardly enough of this perennial agriculture being done to present a threat to them. I don't think it's the sort of business they want to do. But I also think that we are facing enough of a crisis, really, with a growing human population, diminishing natural habitats, a mass extinction in process. We have to come up with every possible way of feeding the human population without further wiping out other populations. And there's a place in that for GMOs that reduce the use of fossil fuels or water or increase yield. There's a place in that for perennial agriculture. There's a place for anything that will further the overall mission.
Allison, what's your take on that?
Well, something I think about is that most of our societies are based on very few species of plants. There are over 350,000 species of flowering plants, of which very few we actually eat. And one of the things that the Land Institute and St. Louis University and the Missouri Botanical Garden are working together to do, using the database and the resources at the Missouri Botanical Garden that Wendy mentioned, is to filter through what we know about wild biodiversity. For example, there are almost 20,000 species of beans out there, of which in the bean family, of which we know relatively little about their potential for agriculture and their potential for domestication and potential use as crops. And so what we're really interested in doing here is taking the information, the knowledge that the botanical community has accumulated at botanical gardens and elsewhere, and beginning to apply it for potential use in developing these novel crops and novel agricultural systems.
Well, Scott, what this is going to mean, and again, as Wendy has just pointed out, we're at the very early stages of all of this. Aren't we really talking about changing the eating habits of the American public and people from all over the world, perhaps?
Possibly, but I think we... and by we, I mean the very royal plural we as human beings have changed our eating habits on a fairly regular basis the entire time we've been a civilization. Mm-hmm. Just as an example pops to mind, corn syrup was not in most of the food that we eat when I'm 51. Corn syrup was not in most of the food that I ate growing up as a kid, even though I ate plenty of sugar. Mm-hmm. and it is now. And so these changes, I think it has a lot to do with what drives those changes. And for us at the Land Institute, our primary interest is in again back to that notion of nature as measure, that we do what makes sense for the natural systems upon which we depend and for the communities that depend upon them, and we have an agriculture now that has been very productive and we have all benefited from it, but it's largely driven by capital and technological and industrial models. And as Wendy said, this is not a wholesale displacement at any point. So either in the system or really in the food products, I think we have a new variety of grain that has just been made into a beer by a partner, Patagonia Provisions, which is a unit of Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company. Mm-hmm. But they're starting a food line. And so there's a beer that's been made with this grain. It's an intermediate wheat grass that we call Kernza that has been in development with the Land Institute and our partners for intensively for about 15 years, but really for longer than that. There's some excitement about this new product, but it's winding up in it. Beer's nothing new, and I think that's what we're going to see is that there may be new ingredients or new crops. Very often, they're going to find their way into foodstuffs that we already know we like.
So, Wendy, we're talking about a very gradual process. I gather from what Scott has just said, this is something that will evolve over, I would assume, a very long period of time.
I would assume so as well. There are cases when the introduction of a new crop is embraced so rapidly that, you know, when potatoes were introduced to Ireland, within a couple centuries, everybody was eating potatoes at every meal, and that actually turned out not to be such a good thing. But there have to be real strong reasons to completely change how things are done so quickly, and I think it's unusual. Probably we'll have a patchwork of different types of agriculture is what's envisioned for a long time.
Allison, how do you see this evolution?
Well, I think agricultural societies around the world have been based on really the same families, grasses and legumes in every agricultural center where domestication first started. A member of the grass family and a member of the legume family was brought into cultivation, with different species and those families being brought into cultivation in different areas. And so I don't see it as that big of a leap, because this project is focusing on those two families. They're super diverse, and we use a very small number of species today. But there's, I guess I agree with Scott. I don't see it as a huge departure from what we know in terms of what we're actually eating. The departure is in the lifespan of the plants, that they are perennial, and that they're grown in mixtures in a polyculture.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think in some ways the bigger impact in the initial years or decades might be how the crops are grown, and the impact that has upon land management, farmers, and agricultural communities, which we would intend to be, you know, if not universally, as wholly positive as we could influence.
Another big issue in the agricultural field today, and a big presence in are the so-called industrial farms. What happens to them? Anything?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't know that I know what it would mean. I mean, certainly it's a different model. It's a different business model. If you could wholesale sort of supplant the annual monoculture industrialized agricultural model with a perennial polyculture nature as measure model, it would be a different business model. It would probably put more people on the land, and it would probably create, as we envision it, we believe it would probably be a more vital rural community fabric. I don't know that. I mean, I think there could be some significant changes in agriculture and agricultural communities, but I don't, and that they might not be what we would think of as industrialized farms. But the fact is, we have to feed a lot of people. I mean, the plants that we focus on, grains, legumes, and pulses, or essentially grains, pulses, and oil seeds, and pulses are essentially dried legumes. That that's anywhere from 56% to 85% of the caloric intake per capita annually of the global population. So agriculture at all sorts of scales and all sorts of types of agriculture will always play a role, but that's a lot of food to produce, and so it has to scale up.
Obviously a lot of interest in this, because you have an event tonight. That all the seats are filled, as I understand.
That's
it.
Good
and
to
a
know.
Lot of a lot of people are going to turn out to hear more about this. Fascinating indeed. I mean, who would have thought it, that we want to turn back to nature to farm? It seems almost counterintuitive. But thank you all so much for being with us. We've got to end it right there.
Thank you, Don.
Scott
thank
Allegrucci
you.
With the Land Institute, thanks so much for being with us. Wendy Applequist, thank you so much for being with us. And Allison Miller, thank you also. Most fascinating discussion indeed. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.